It's the new year, time to make a positive change in your life.
I went to My Computer Career because I needed job security.
Because I wanted a career in cybersecurity.
I went to My Computer Career because IT jobs are everywhere.
My old job was going nowhere.
I went because I didn't want college loans for the rest of my life.
Because I wanted a career for the rest of my life.
Go to mycomputercareer.edu and take the free career evaluation today. Financial aid available for qualified students, including the GI Bill. 529 college savings plans accepted. Not available in Washington State.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Jacob Abrahamson. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Now, you work in acquisitions for Nonstop Entertainment, a Scandinavian distributor, and you're also one half of Miller Films with Patrick Anderson, a Swedish production company that, and I quote, aims to be the place where ambitious film and TV projects rooted in Nordic folklore and appealing to a global audience. That sound about right?
That sounds about right. Absolutely.
Good man. Well, look, let us, for the sake of this interview, let's focus on your work at Nonstop Entertainment. And as a sort of broad summary, I mean, I said you're a distributor in Scandinavia, but what, how would you describe the company Nonstop Entertainment? How would you summarize what you do?
I would first say it's a fairly old company for being an independent distributor. I think we're turning 27 this year, which means that we've been through a lot of changes in the business. When the company was started, before I even joined, it was VHS that was booming. We then had the DVD and Blu-ray bonanza. And then around 2010 in Scandi, Netflix and HBO launched. And it took maybe a couple of years before the business to be completely and utterly transformed. And of course, as everyone knows, post-pandemic and also post-streaming platform crunch, the film and distribution world is vastly different.
So with that in mind then, what would you say are challenges in front of you that wouldn't have been challenges behind you?
It's been going on for quite some time, but to have a film succeed, it needs to stand out. This may sound very obvious, but it is also true. It needs a hook. There needs to be some sort of ideally a story to tell about the film, not just the story in the film. Mm-hmm. Just a good filming, quotation marks, does not necessarily transformed to tickets sold in the cinema, and unfortunately does not always transform into iTunes rentals or other sorts of streaming revenues either. It is becoming much more polarized, much more hit and miss. So if you pick up something, and Nonstop has a slate of I guess upmarket films, but also with a splash of horror and genre and so on. So last year we had films like the Berlin winner Dahomey, a documentary about Benin statues being returned from France by Mati Diop, a really great film, but also of course not the biggest audience. Such a film we would acquire because it is really good and it should get out there. But I think we've sold tickets in the hundreds rather than in the thousands.
Okay.
In the other end of the spectra, we have stuff like The Substance, which we picked up at Cannes last year, which is absolutely, you obviously don't know this from the get-go, but when it was screened in Cannes, it was a bit of a sensation, but because it was a really good film, but I guess people were not expecting this, and we're not expecting this from Demi Moore, or Carly, for that matter, that she would take such a huge step from the rather great Revenge, but it's a huge step forward.
Indeed.
And upwards. And then that film would eventually become sort of a talking point, a recurring thing in the public mindset in being discussed on TikTok and by influencers, but also in newspapers and magazines and so on. And of course, herself especially has been working so hard. I think she's so brave of first doing the film, risking it all, really. If it wouldn't have worked, it could have been just a huge mistake somehow. And then once it took off, realizing that this is actually her chance of hopefully getting that actor recognition she has not had that well so far. So she's been working so hard on the PR circuit, not at all being your image of a Hollywood diva saying no to things. She's been everywhere and still is. And this has been amazing. And the film right now, when we record this, has just been obviously won a Golden Globe, when Demi Moore won one, and which is a rare feat for us, has topped the local iTunes chart, all the local, basically.
Really?
TV charts. That doesn't happen for an Oslo film. Typically, it's the Gladiators or the Inside Outs that take that position. So that is, even though that film cost a lot to acquire, on our scale of things, it was a big bet. It has paid off tremendously because the film just keeps on delivering. And I'm pretty sure it will continue to do that. Also successful last year was Terrifier 3. We got on the Terrifier train with part 2.
Okay.
And that took off in the US. So when part 3 showed up on the horizon, we made sure to acquire it, of course. And that took off actually in box office numbers in Scandinavia, even bigger than Substance. And obviously, it's been tremendously successful in the US as well. And I think there are, I'm just going off here, but stop me if you need to. But I think there's a couple of interesting points here that the Substance is successful because it's a great film. It's a bold film, but it also got the creative people working very hard to promote it. And Terrifier is very successful because it's pushes boundaries. It is the real deal, so to speak. It's an firmly independent film, produced and owned by the director and the producer. They could have, after part two, gone to a studio, and I think they had plenty of offers. They stuck to their guns. And when the film then grossed more than $50 million in the U.S., they own that film. They made a shitload of money. And I couldn't be more happy for them, because they prove that, at least what the magazines say, it cost about $2 million to make. The budget was minuscule. I'm sure they didn't pay themselves that much because they were gunning for a big reward later. But that means that a very contained risk-taking, basically, in terms of money and budget, delivers plentiful, and the money stays within the independent film circuit, with the filmmakers and the independent distributors, the independent sales agent, the Cowen based in France, and in our end of the world, partly with us. Obviously, we send back royalties. But I think this is amazing in a world where a lot of films are being made for streamers. And if you make a film, or at least, I guess that's shifting again, but if you make a film for Netflix, or another stream, they would pay budget plus a premium, a percentage on top to buy you out. So even if the film is vastly successful, that's what you get. And that means that it's harder to get finance for independent films as well, because it's never sure if you're going to get your money back, and that's part of the game. But if the potential windfall is limited to maybe whatever, 20, 30, 50% of the investment, that is, of course, something, but it's not like than Terrifier, scoring hundreds or maybe even thousands of percents return on investment for the people who put in that money. And if the independent film market can prove itself that way, doing smart filmmaking for contained amounts of money but doing great things, I think that's a way forward in this world. Pretty dark world we're in general, but also in terms of independent film distribution. It's easy to be gloomy and say everything is owned by platforms and studios and there's not much room to maneuver. But this little killer clown actually proved that it is possible.
Yeah.
And a final note there is I think both Substance and Terrifier and Long Legs and a lot of other films that came out, kids today, but I think also grown-ups, are enjoying going to the cinema to see a film on the big screen if it is a communal experience. And when actually, for different reasons, I guess, very few comedies are made these days, unless it's superheroes, Deadpool stuff. Horror films are one of the few genres where you actually go to the cinema and you live the film with a full audience. You scream and you gasp together.
Yeah.
And kids today see that value. I guess they do that for Deadpool as well. They're screaming and gasp for that too. But that film costs a little bit more to make. But for a low-budget horror film to achieve that, that's amazing. And getting repeat viewings in the cinema where groups of friends are coming back, that's amazing. And that's also why it's very interesting. We're not only doing horror, but why I think the horror,
yeah,
horror stuff is extra interesting nowadays.
Yeah, I was going to say because one of the interesting things for me as a horror fan is that you see the mainstream press reporting on the success of these outliers in terms of how we understand the market right now, and it's like we've forgotten that horror can be like this. there's kind of a perpetual amnesia that goes, oh, horror's not going to do anything. Then horror arrives and go, horror's back.
Yeah.
Until the next time the Guardian will write that headline or the Telegraph will write that headline or something, you know, where they're telling their audience that horror's back, whereas horror doesn't go anywhere. So is there anything that you can see that we can bottle? No, we can never bottle success easily enough. But, I mean, you started off by saying that a film has to stand out. Well, I guess Substance won the best screenplay at one of the biggest film festivals in the world.
Yes.
You know, it had a star in it who, like you said, then ended up seeing the opportunity and used her star power to give the film more airtime to an audience that wouldn't normally walk up and see a body horror film. If you build it as a body horror film, they wouldn't go. But if you go Demi Moore in a daring role, then people want to see Demi Moore in a daring role, don't they? And I guess on the other side of it, with Terrifier, you've got that rites of passage, which is dare you watch this film, in a really reductive sense. But that was like, can they better the last one? Well, the only way I can find out is if I go and see it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think both those films also, maybe Terrifier even more, are very friendly for the fans to play with, that they can film themselves watching the film and putting that online. They can dress up as art. And one of my colleagues in the Nonstop office, Mirva, when she was on her way home before Christmas, she saw kids, fairly tiny, like 12-year-olds, with an art a clown mask and a camera doing their own Terrifier film, which was absolutely beautiful. I should then add as well, in Sweden, our censorship laws are slightly different from other countries. We've traditionally been very harsh on violence, but friendly on nudity.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, there is no censorship for grown-ups. If you're over 15, you can see anything and the films can be completely uncut.
Right.
But they changed the law a couple of years back. So if you're between 11 and 15, you can see a film from 15 if you bring a grown-up.
Mm-hmm.
So basically in Sweden, 11-year-olds could see Terrifier 3 in cinemas.
Mind-blowing.
Yes, I don't think this is the case in many other countries. And interestingly, there seems to be not the majority of the audience, but a good chunk of the audience was like 12-year-olds dragging their parents to see Terrifier. And I'm a parent as well, but I'm also a horror fan, so I'm both sort of amazed, a little bit horrified, but I think that there is a typical rites of passage thing going here. Uh-huh. And I also think that whatever images kids nowadays get through their phones, uh-huh, they, if they're so inclined, that they can find war, violence, whatever. Atrocities. So it's I'm not saying we were squeamish when we were kids, but I think sort of the general just being familiar with violent shit, basically, it goes down in ages.
But I mean, I can't help but think as well, though, the films you've described, the documentary you described, compared to these horror films you've described that you've worked, that companies worked on. How does a company like Nonstop sort of keep abreast of those two very divergent directions for film to be going? You know, what's a good documentary to pick up versus what's a good splatter film to pick up? They don't seem to be like you could be around the same board table going, what should we acquire?
I guess that this is one of the perks of being independent and being your own boss, that we can basically acquire any film that we like if we think it has potential and the price is right. Having said that, being an independent distributor and producer and whatever is not necessarily a huge revenue stream and a huge paycheck, but if you keep your bets contained and sometimes sort of man up, like with the substance that did cost a lot more than Dahomey, for instance. But Dahomey, we paid a reasonable price for what it is.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, we will not earn money in the cinemas, but it will get recognition, it got reviews, and hopefully we'll sell it to local public broadcaster. And maybe it's not a huge breadwinner, but it's a really good film, and we're happy to sort of help push it out. And this is also, I didn't mention, but we're also buying a whole lot of classic films. We have about 350 classic films in distribution, most of them on DCP for the local Nordic market. And the same goes there. Occasionally, a classic takes off and sells a good number of tickets in the cinemas, but it's really a long game and something you do because it's like being a kid in a candy store. Now I don't go try to find the films I want to see and like on DVD. I try to buy the rights to distribute them in Scandi. And if you then, it took about 5 years to negotiate El Topo and the Holy Mountain.
Really?
And when that deal closed, yeah, that's a good feeling. That's feeling, even though the money involved and the money we've earned is not that big, that feeling is as good as buying the substance, because those are all-time greats that you get hold of finally.
And so have those films never been distributed in Scandinavia?
They had been in cinemas back in the day, I'm sure. But they had been out of distribution for a good number of years.
I mean, just without getting into any financial stuff, but for that 5 year time to negotiate, is that to do with finding chain of title and ownership, or is that just a 5 year negotiation?
Sometimes it can be trying to find actually the right person or the right company. And for some obscure classics, you can find them being represented by companies that you don't actually know if they are legit or not. They'll send you an email and send you a list of titles. And we try really hard to do our diligence there. So one obvious thing is obviously to look at Blu-ray covers and see what logos and copyright notices are and try to Google those or ask distributors in other countries. Whatever the Arrows, the Severins, and
got you.
Try to get hold of Criterion and track them down. In terms of the Khodorkovskys, it was basically that the company, which is Alan Klein's old company that also was the Stones manager once upon a time, first didn't think the timing was right. So I knocked on their door, maybe 6 months or something, and said, what about now? No, sorry. What about now? Sorry. And in a way, that was a very Japanese procedure because that's how you deal with that's the procedure if you want to get sort of your foot in the door with a classic Japanese studio. If you want to do a deal with Toho, you don't just show up and expect to close the deal at the same day. It will take getting to know them, them to get to know you, and you need to show persistence and that you're serious about things. So, but eventually, the Khodorkovsky company said, okay, now we can discuss. And then it took, I guess, a couple of months to negotiate the deal as well.
That's quite, I mean, that's a really interesting insight because, you know, you think, if I think about the challenges that we kind of, that were implicit in how we started the conversation for making money from film, the idea that somebody coming along and saying, I want to help you make money out of a film that's already made. And that's a challenge in of itself for you still. That's a really interesting, you know, insight into the mechanisms of distributing movies, that it's not just a case of, I'll do it. It's like, well, hold on a minute. Are you right? Is it the right time? You know, these kind of things. We have to, I'm guessing they're thinking, we have to maximize the impact of this if we're going to give rights away, because it affects other markets, doesn't it? I suppose it has a knock-on effect.
Exactly. So if you own classic films or libraries, you do want to sort of sometimes more often the films needs to be restored, and then you want the best proper place to do your premiere of the restored print, and maybe that's a classic film festival, or maybe it's a classic section in a major film festival like a Cannes Classics or something, or maybe it's an anniversary that you want to sort of wait for, or maybe you can get the talent there or not, or whatever. There's a million things that you ideally won't want to fall into place, and if you're up in Sweden and the Nordics, no one will prioritize Nordics to go first. Basically, you'll wait for the country of origin, or US or UK or France or whatever it is.
Well, look, well, thank you for sharing that about Nonstop Entertainment and giving us that little window into the world of distribution of new films as well as classics. And now we shall move into three films.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
That have impacted everything in your adult life. Are you ready for this?
I think I am. As ready as I'll be.
Well, look, just for the listener who might have tuned in for this first time round, the rules are simple. Jacob's giving me a list of three films that have impacted on him, and we'll get 5 minutes to talk about each film. And every time we hear this sound, Jacob, that is when the 5 minutes are up, and then we'll move on to the next film. Okay?
Yes.
The clock is ticking, and for the first one, it's a British production that became regarded as one of the best British horror films of the 50s. It's listed as one of Martin Scorsese's favourite horror films. The image of the creature from this film is iconic to 50s horror. And before its release in the US, the film was retitled Curse of the Demon from Night of the Demon, its original one. It was also cut, which I didn't know till doing this bit of research, from 95 to 82 minutes for the US. I am indeed talking about Curse of the Demon, directed by Jacques Tourneur, Cat People, I Walk with a Zombie. But tell us, Jacob, what's the impact for you? Where do you see this film?
when I was a teenager, during the summers, I used to work in a local convenience store. Mm-hmm. That store happened to be closer to my grandmother's apartment, and she usually was away in a cottage, so I stayed at her apartment, and she had cable TV, which we didn't when I was a kid.
Okay.
So when you got home, I just sat there, watched MTV and stuff, and it was a thing called Super Channel, which was mostly crap, but come midnight, they would always put on black and white horror. Every like 5 minutes that there was commercial break, and somehow I had realized that Curse of the Demon, as I think it was known there and then, was something to sort of watch. So I sat there, even though I was going to go up early next morning to sit at the till in the store with my VHS recorder, sort of recording it, pausing for every ad, starting it again, pausing, starting it again. And this is how I saw the film the first time. Not the best circumstances, but I was still blown away. And the creature, the demon, is of course iconic, but I think one of the strengths of the films, as with many Jacques Tourneur films, is actually the tension built up before that, before the payoff. That's amazing. It was really scary then. And this is all the time when I was basically watching Fulcis and Argentos and so on. Yeah. So, but few of those actually equaled the build-up and sort of the uncanny uncanny feeling of Curse of the Demon. Since then, I watched it many times again, but it has stuck with me. And I think also that this makes me sound like a very old man, and maybe I'm getting there, but stuff that you have to fight for, that takes a bit of effort to actually get hold of, always stays with you. The reward is bigger, basically, if you have to track it down. Or
are you suggesting that it's much easier now to just Google?
I am, actually. And to some extent, that is great, of course, because somehow you could get hold of stuff. But I also, I think it had a point, that thing when you read about a film and you got hold of it a couple of years later, borrowed it or bought it somewhere. Being a Swede, you went to London basically to buy obscure stuff and get it, hopefully, see my
really?
Cut
as
well.
That was the normal route, was to come to London and then and get what you want.
Absolutely.
That way.
Absolutely. And that could be old horror or the old Tartan Hong Kong films or stuff that was hard to get in Scandi. Absolutely.
Can I ask you, how many times did you say you recorded this with the adverts edited out, which I've done the same thing. Mm. So how many times do you think you watched your edited version that obviously goes like leaps between?
I would say that's probably a handful of times. I got it on DVD basically as soon as I could later, and I've seen it on a screen as well.
So how many years later, though, between those kind of chopped-up edited version and you seeing a full version?
That's probably 15 years or something.
Amazing. So
there is a gap there. There is a gap.
Yeah.
And let me tell you another thing. Sort of a Bible back in the day was Incredible Strange Films, a lovely book from research.
Yeah.
And stuff you read about in there, that those have stuck with me. So it's just a year ago I finally got hold of and saw Larry Cohen's God Told Me To. And I've been longing for that film since like 1988. That sort of build up and payoff, oh my God. And it's a great film. It was amazing.
We are at our first 5 minutes. What a great place to stop. I have to ask, when you get to see a film that you've wanted to see because of however the Incredibly Strange film presented to you, you've imagined a film and it's played and there's different versions played, then you get to see it. How did that play out for you with God Told Me So?
I thought it was amazing. Maybe I liked it even more after all this time, but also me being a grown-up seeing it, maybe I would have thought it sort of not tough enough back in the day. But now, that old 70s New York, and it's I've been recently watching a lot of 70s New York films from like Death Wish to I forget the name, but that area. That was a great payoff. Another one that I, that was actually on the cover of my edition of Incredible Strange Films. I think there's several different ones, but The Mask, a Canadian 3D horror film.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Which was just, it's just a strange sort of cranium built on tiny facets on the cover. And that showed up at the Toronto Film Festival. I didn't know it was a Canadian film, restored, and was shown in a cinema in 3D.
Wow.
So basically, when the main protagonist takes on a mask, an ancient Mayan mask, I think, he goes on a killer spree, and that's when you put on your 3D glasses, and the film goes just bananas.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Right then, sir. Your second film is Tobe Hooper's sequel to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the 1974 brutal horror film, and then turns around and does a black satire. The family group shot on the front of the cover was based on the promotional group shot for the movie The Breakfast Club. If anyone's seen the iconic stuff of Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, I didn't know that. Originally, the title was going to be Beyond the Valley of Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, wow.
But the studio forced considerable changes to the screenplay, even kicking Kim Henkel off and getting Kit Carson in. And the result of the changes became Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. So tell me about skipping school to catch a banned film.
Yeah, so Sweden had its own set of video nasties. Basically, there was a TV program in the early 80s that showed clips of The Burning or the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre and said, this is available in video stores in Sweden and your kids can see this. Isn't it horrible? And there was a huge outcry, and politicians even put in a sort of a punitive tax on buying a VHS recorder and VHS tapes.
Wow.
So again, going to London, it was half price to buy VHS tapes in London compared to Sweden because there was this extra tax on them because of this program and this sort of local video nasty scare. So getting hold of uncut films, that was both hard but also a sport. And then when the Swedish Cinematheque, in all their wisdom and grace, decided to put on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2, and just screened on a weekday afternoon in the middle of the city. And I think I was in high school by then, but it was a fairly easy choice to just sort of skip school, go there, see it on a screen, because that, if you would have gone all of it, it would have been a crappy VHS tape. So seeing it on a 35mm print, that was wild and crazy. And also, I guess, opened a door. I knew about the Cinematheque and had been there a couple of times, but also to what they could do and would do. That it's, I do like, as we started a lot of classic films, but back in those days, that they basically thought this was a good idea and dare do it. I thought that was beautiful. And you may see a recurring theme here, that films that I picked and that mean a lot and I thought shaped myself somehow all took some effort to sort of get to see.
So Stockholm Cinematheque then. So that was what? A kind of art house cinema, or was it a club, or?
It's like the films are being programmed at BFI South Bank in London,
okay.
I guess,
okay.
or the French Cinematheque. So retrospectives mostly.
Yeah.
Some new films typically would be like a complete Fritz Lang retrospective or the complete Buñuel retrospective, which I saw the complete one, which was amazing. And I went to film theory class. But then they would go off on, being a little more unruly. They also had something they called the Friday Goodies or Nasties or something, where they showed like a lot of silent Todd Browning films or early Guy Madden films, or were mixing it up, I guess, a bit. That was also Pretty great.
Because I mean, for in London, the equivalent of that we might show the Texas Chainsaw Massacre would be Prince Charles rather than the BFI South Bank.
Yes, yeah, that is true. We don't have that, or maybe it's coming now, but we've never had that sort of repertoire cult cinema thing, and we never had anything like The Scala, for instance. And I love the documentary about The Scala, and if you who listen haven't seen it, dig that out. There's a great documentary about possibly the best programming ever at the cinema.
The directors were on here talking about it when it came out.
Stays as they should be. Yeah,
indeed. So, what I mean, I've never seen Texas Chainsaw 2 on the big screen. What do you remember? What's an abiding memory of being able to catch it on 35mm then?
Back then, obviously, the 35mm in itself was nothing special. Everything was on 35.
Oh. Finish your thought.
But seeing it on a big screen and crisp image, that was something, because most of the films you get hold of, if you want to watch horror, were dupes of dupes of dupes, so that they were sort of not the greatest quality. Sometimes they would even go black and white, but you would still sit through them to see that film you longed for.
I still believe that my first watching of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which remained banned until 2001 in the UK, is still the best one, and that was a dupe of a dupe of a dupe. But the illicitness attached to the watching on a 20-inch UHT TV, it's still the best. I mean, I've been lucky enough to see it at the Empire Leicester Square on a 70-foot screen, so that, you know, that was an amazing experience. But the grubbiness of watching it was definitely there with that first viewing. And talking of grubby and watching films, that's a nice segue into your third film. Which I was heartened to learn that the majority of the trailer for your third choice was created on a Commodore 64 computer, which for computer nerds, that's a blast that I wasn't expecting. It's a movie Andy Warhol hailed as the Clockwork Orange of the 80s. And given its grimness and its pessimism, it's unsurprising this was a box office flop, but like other 1980s genre movies that suffered a similar fate, like The Thing, Home Entertainment ensured that it found an audience and is now part of the Criterion Collection, Spying 248. I'm indeed talking about David Cronenberg's 1983 movie, Videodrome. So tell me, in a censorious country like Sweden, how are you getting hold of Videodrome?
This is, I guess, end of high school somewhere. There was a huge, it's gone now, but I guess the Glastonbury of Sweden called Hultsfred Music Festival.
Okay.
Where you brought your tent and you expected a lot of mud, a lot of alcohol, and hopefully some great bands. There was a little stand, and most of them were selling like a band t-shirts or didgeridoos or whatever. Unnecessary stuff, but there was a stand that was selling VHS films basically, and had a lot of imports, mostly from the UK again. And I had been longing for Videodrome Uncut. I knew that the Swedish edition was super cut, really, like the most of both in the beginning, but especially the end was gone supposedly. So I didn't want to see it until I got the full version, and I found it there. So I bought it, but I couldn't really be bothered to go back to my tent. So I had to sort of stuff it under my shirt, in my pants when I went out to party and to concert that night. And thankfully, I managed to keep it and not destroy it. And then when I got home to see it, completely blown away. It's I think it's still a fucking masterpiece. And I think that a lot of the themes in it are even more current than back then. It's it's almost pathetic, but it's fantastic to see a film again nowadays that was obviously transgressive then, but still feel that. That's quite an achievement. And as you said, Criterion has released it, and now I'm going to brag a little bit, but I was visiting the Criterion office last year, and they let me into the closet, not like an official thing that they put on their Instagram or something, but I got to go there and got to hold a film and take a photograph of myself. And if anyone wanted to find my Instagram, is there. And that's Videodrome. I'm standing in the Criterion closet with the Videodrome Blu-ray in my hands. That's how much that film means to me.
It is. I mean, I remember seeing that film as a 14, 15-year-old, and it properly troubled me because I don't think I'd really seen... I'd seen gory films, but I'd not seen ones that sort of mess with your mind. And now I'm a bit older and I've read, say, Fahrenheit 451. It feels like a continuum on that line where media's going to... The worry that media's going to mess us up, and in Fahrenheit 451, it's more about banning it, and this one's about how we're just completely seduced by it. It's... And a Brian Oblivion, the sort of the character, you know, the Messiah, as it were, is apparently based on the Canadian philosopher Marshall McLuhan, who obviously gave us the medium is the message as a phrase. Which
I'm not going to try to be make a huge social commentary here, but obviously, as you say, the film is about a medium then see my new or going in new places and maybe the threats of it or the controlling aspects of it. And it's not hard to see parallels to discussions about social media and TikTok these days.
Yeah.
What is that doing to us? And I guess Cronenberg saw the inherent properties of TV and video back then, but what he saw is still valid very much.
Well, I think it's that, I guess he's playing with what was the ultimate fear, which was once, we're at the 5 minutes there, sorry, I'll just finish my thought. It was and it was one of the things that, you know, fueled the video nasty panic in this country, in the UK, was the idea of we could stop and rewind stuff. Whereas before, we would just push stuff out and we received it. And then suddenly, I remember the first time I watched a music show that went out on a Thursday night, and I was watching it at a friend's house on a Friday, and this was mind blowing. The idea that now obviously I could be at a bus stop on my phone and pull up the whole bloody series of music shows I want and just be bored out of my head in about 5 minutes because there's too much choice. But that idea of controlling and therefore us being controlled by it's really good that he spotted it. Cause I mean, a bit like I say, 451, Fahrenheit 451 was the idea that for the government were to ban books. Well, the government hasn't had to ban books. It seems it just needs to make people more stupid and they'll just stop reading without even being told to.
No, absolutely. Again, I think we're entering, old man thinking territory here, but I also actually think it's true.
Old man is shouting at the sky for sure. I definitely feel like that sometimes, but I think there won't be long before we get things like certificate 18 on social media, for example. You know, that's not that wild, and I don't think I'm being protective. Well, look, thank you for sharing those three films and those stories attached to them. That was really interesting. And before you go, do you want to tell us anything about what Scandinavia can look forward to in 2025 that you'll be distributing? Anything you're excited about that's going to hit the big screens of Scandinavia?
From us, we're going to launch Andrea Arnold's Bird, which I think is a lovely one. We have Mike Leigh's Hard Truths coming as well. Mm-hmm. And we have... a film called The Home. It's a Swedish film based on a book by a Swedish horror writer called Mats Strandberg.
Yeah.
He wrote the book that became The Conference on Netflix. Mm-hmm. If anyone saw that, sort of a slasher comedy, which went pretty wide. And that's, it's a really scary film taking place in, a home for sort of elderly people that are need assistance and maybe have see my dementia and maybe one of those is haunted by something or someone.
That sounds good.
I've just saw the finished version the other day, and it's going to come for the fall in Sweden. And maybe when this comes out, there will be an announcement on an international film festival as well. We'll see.
Nice one.
Well, look, it just gives me to say thank you very much for giving us your time on the BritFlix podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a delight.
It's the new year. Time to make a positive change in your life.
I went to My Computer Career because I needed job security.
Because I wanted a career in cybersecurity.
I went to My Computer Career because IT jobs are everywhere.
My old job was going nowhere.
I went because I didn't want college loans for the rest of my life.
Because I wanted a career for the rest of my life.
Go to mycomputercareer.edu and take the free career evaluation today. Financial aid available for qualified students, including the GI Bill. 529 college savings plans accepted. Not available in Washington State.